How do we work with a stuck relationship that's being fed by anger and depression? Dr. Sue Johnson is the creator of Emotionally Focused Therapy, and she once had a couple who was in deep distress. But Sue often looks for the hot point in these situations, the emotional trigger, and this is how she found it.
I get a referral from an individual therapist who says, my client is chronically depressed in the last year. She's getting worse and worse. And it's because the only thing that's really happening is that she's married to a narcissist. And would you see them as a couple? So unfortunately, all individual therapists think that their clients are married to narcissists. But that's sort of, you know, because you identify with your client. But I see this couple, and the man is he's very sophisticated. He is very concerned about his wife's depression, and he lectures her and gives her advice and says that she's depressed since her friend died, and if only she'd go to the gym, and if only she'd talk to him more. And if only she'd listen to his advice, and if only she did more exercise, everything would be okay. And then when she turns away from him, he becomes angrier and angrier and angrier and says that she's not listening to him, and if she's not careful, she's going to get more depressed. So what is this? Well, this is a much more sophisticated picture than just saying, well, this man is a narcissist, or he's going through some midlife crisis, or he's too controlling, all right? So what's interesting about that couple, we try to find the exact place where the stuckness in dealing with your emotion and dealing with other people comes up. And if you follow the emotion, it comes up in therapy. So I ask his wife, who is very withdrawn, doesn't want to talk to me. I said, your husband believes that this started, you know, they're an empty nest couple, right? They've been together for a long time. They seem to have had a good relationship for many years. Your husband seems to believe this depression started when your friend died, when you went away to help your friend. And she said, yes, he believes that. So then I have to work, you know, to get her to engage with me, because she's stuck in withdrawal and shutdown, right? And so I'm talking to her and I say, well, I'm really interested in you. I'm interested in when things went wrong for you. We start talking about how she's stuck. She didn't use that word. She said, I'm in a dark place in myself and in my relationship. So we start talking about that. And then we go into, well, what is the, and I'm looking for the trigger. Right? What is the trigger for you in all this? And she says, it started on the train station in France, which was it was quite recent, about a year before, right? Which is exactly when her depression started, whereas her friend died like 3 years before, right? So I said, oh, really? What happened? So then she talks about the fact that she'd gone hiking and her husband had been irritated with her because she hadn't gone to the gym enough and she hadn't exercised enough. And so she'd fallen and hurt her knee. So you get this sort of managerial style. You get this image from him that he's always trying to manage her, right? And she was feeling bad because he was irritated with her. And they were on a station in France and they're waiting for a train. And suddenly she's standing there with a cup of coffee and with their case. So she's just sort of, you know, waiting because the train's not going to take off for at least an hour. And then suddenly he realizes the train's moving. So he runs because he's a very athletic guy. He really believes in, he exercises 3 hours a day, right? So he runs and he screams at the conductor and he gets on the train and the train starts to slow again. And he's on the train and he turns to his wife and he screams, run. Well, his wife is, you know, she's just standing there with coffee. She doesn't know what he's talking about. So it really takes her quite a few moments to realize what's going on. And, you know, then she's got to run after this moving train with her luggage. So somehow, with a bad knee. So somehow she manages it. She runs, she drops her coffee, she runs. She finally manages to get onto the train, and he turns and he says to her, "Why are you so goddamn slow?" And she goes into the carriage and she says to herself, "I've been married to this man for all these years. I can never please him. I've never pleased him. Maybe he's right. Maybe I am slow. Maybe there's something wrong with me. I'll never be able to please this man." Now, listen to all this. This is she's moving into a way of dealing with her emotion where she just gets caught in all this shame and rejection and fear and despair. And then she comes up with meanings, which is, there is something wrong with me. I am inadequate. I'll never please him. I'll never have a good relationship. I'm really on my own here. All these negative stuck thoughts. And she also deals with it in a way that keeps her stuck, in that she shuts down. So she's stuck. And so I say, "I understand." So I start talking to her about that. I start helping her put together her response so that she starts to listen to her emotions, get what's happened to her. You know, and as you go into that and help people explicate and sort of take the elements of their experience and put it together in a new way, in a way it's a bit like mindfulness. As you get people to sit with their experience and be aware of it, and not judge it, but just taste it and be aware of it, it starts to shift, right? So she starts to say, "Yes, that's right. I go into despair. And the only thing I can do right now is to protect myself. And I know that I'm getting more and more depressed, but I can't seem to move. I'm paralyzed." So she actually starts to be able to say that. And just putting your emotions together starts to change them, right? We know that. We know that Matt Lieberman, the neuroscientist, talks about the fact that just naming emotions really accurately starts to change the way your amygdala responds to them. It starts to calm you down because you're ordering your experience. It's not just happening to you, you're ordering it. So she starts to talk to me in a less withdrawn way. And she starts to talk more than about dark. She starts to talk about, yes, she feels small around him. She can never please him. So she's, you know, starting to get into her experience. And then I turn to him and I start to work with him. He can't hear any of it. He basically just says, "Well, you know, if you'd only listen to me." And what I get is that he's in his head and he manages his life and he manages his wife. And you have to wonder, what is he managing? Well, in the end, you know, it's basically his own anxiety. So I talk to him about, I go into the stuck place. I go into, which is, he's doing now what he did on the train, basically. He's telling her who she is. He's managing her. So I say, "So let's go back. Let's go back onto the station." The experiential therapist goes into the stuck place. You don't try to get people, don't try to go around it or give them superficial solutions. You go into the stuckness. You change it with a corrective experience from the inside. So then he says, I say, "Tell me what you see. You jump on the train. What happens? It's got to be alive emotionally to do this." And he says, "Well, the train's moving." I say, "Yes, I understand. And what's happening? Look back. What do you see?" And see, he's talking about an incident, but he's talking about how he processes experience, his relationship. He's talking about the whole thing in this microcosm. He says, "She's not moving." I said, "I understand. Tell me what's happening." He says, "Well, she's not moving. She's not running to be with me. Right? She's standing still on the station." I said, "Yes, right. And what's happening to you?" He says, "Well, like my blood pressure's going up and it's like she's," I say to myself, "why isn't she moving?" I say, "And then what happens?" He says, you can't do this from the outside. They've got to be in it, right, to make the motion bigger. And I say, "And then what happens?" He says, "Well, the train's moving and she's becoming further and further away. Is she going to run and be with me? Is she going to run to be with me, or am I on the train? And he can't say it. So I say, all by yourself, right? And he starts to weep. And instead of telling his wife what to do all the time, he starts to weep and talk about the fact that the children have left and he doesn't know what to do with himself. He's lost his role as dad. He's starting to think about retirement. And he's suddenly really aware of how much he needs his wife. And he doesn't like that feeling. And maybe there's something wrong with that feeling. And when her friend died, she went off to be with her friend for months, 3 months actually. And he suddenly realized that he was alone, and he's always been alone, and he was alone as a child, and he took care of everyone in his family, and the only person that's ever been close to him is his wife, and he has this dreadful fear of rejection and abandonment, and he can't talk about it, so he tells her what to do all the time. So I'm giving it to you in a huge, you know, it obviously didn't unfold like that. So he comes out of his stuck place, and he starts to talk about his own anxiety in a way that when he does that, what's lovely, and the reason I love couples therapy so much, is that partners change each other in couples therapy. I don't have to work so hard. When he turns and starts talking to her about the fact that actually it isn't that she's so unhealthy or incompetent or you know, it isn't that there's something wrong with her. It's that he's anxious and that he doesn't know how to talk to her about the fact that he needs her. I mean, this is like she suddenly turns around from her withdrawn stance. She spent most of the time looking out the window in my office. She turns around. She looks at him. She moves forward in her chair. Whole body changes. She starts to say, and then she starts to say, oh, so it's you're scared. You're scared. And he starts to be able to ask her for comfort. And she starts to realize that he feels vulnerable. And as he feels vulnerable, she starts to say things like, well, you know, I was slow to get on the train, but when you were sick 2 years ago, I took care of you. I can't run as fast as you. And my knees aren't as strong, but I have a lot of strength. I know how to take care of you. And you can see this woman move into understanding the situation differently, processing her emotion differently, engaging her husband differently, and starting to say things like, I don't want to go to the gym all the time. I don't need to do that. Let's talk about how worried you are about my health and how scared you are that I'm not going to be there for you. This is empowering for her. This is empowering. And so by the end, I only saw them about, I don't know, 6-7 times, I think. By the end of it, he's talking about his fears. He's processing, assessing his emotion in a different way. He's engaging with her in a different way. She's engaging with him totally differently. And so the individual therapist phones me up and says, my client's much better. Thank you so much. What did you do? I said, well, I didn't really do that much. I just did some EFT and went into their stuck places with them. And, you know, they helped each other.
Sue helped her clients to focus on their own problems instead of their partners. I wanted some more thought around this. So here's another take from Dr. Ron Siegel and Bill O'Hanlon.
Well, first is the challenge of getting somebody to focus on themselves rather than the other. I think the Dalai Lama said once, why would you work on transforming your own destructive emotions rather than changing other people's behavior? Why change your behavior first? Because you can, was basically the answer. That we can't change other people very well, yet we do have some shot at it with ourselves. So first there's that level of orientation. But then I think what was very interesting about what Sue Johnson was doing is she's really using new language for something which the depth psychologies have been involved in for, well over a century now, which is, you know, how do you connect to that which isn't conscious? Freud talked about it as, you know, unconscious material, as did Jung and the whole both psychoanalytic and analytical psychology movements. You know, we see the whole realm of people who connect through the body. You know, this was Reich's work of paying attention to the musculature and what's happening here and now in the body. How am I holding, defending against different feelings? And what's this posture trying to speak to? You see Al Lowen's work with bioenergetics. It's an expression of this. Certainly Peter Levine, who's taking part in our series, talks about staying with whatever the sensation is or the feeling is in the body as a way to connect to this. And it's what Dick Schwartz is doing with his internal family systems, with the different parts. Because when you allow a part to speak, that also gets at what's happening implicitly. And I think the really valuable and important thing to remember here is that, you know, Freud was kind of right about elements of the unconscious. There are a lot of parts of our experience that aren't in our awareness. And if we use any one of the many tools, and there are many roads, and Sue suggested that it can't be done with words. I don't think that's entirely true. I think free association will connect us often to all sorts of material that we might not be aware of. Paying attention to dreams will connect us, and that's sort of a verbal technique, to all sorts of things. So there are many royal roads to the unconscious. It's not just dreams, it's the body, it's movement, it's art, it's music, it's free association. There are many, many pathways, and I think we do best as clinicians to be open to the full variety of them, because different channels are going to work for different patients or clients in different moments.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a natural thing when we have trouble and it's interpersonal, we look over there for the source of the trouble. And how do we, without blaming that person, how do we empower that person to take back control? And one of the ways I think is just to pretend that you're the director of the movie rather than the actor in the movie. And I think of a particular example. I had a client who was in college and she was working part time, and she would overextend herself, so she didn't manage her money well. And then she'd have to call up her mother, they'd go out to lunch, and then at the end she'd bring up to her mother, you know, I need some money. And her mother would give her the money, but with a lecture and a really guilt-inducing thing. And then she would just spiral, my client would just spiral after that. She would, you know, just get into a deep funk, and she couldn't go to work. Then she'd have less money. Sometimes she'd get fired. So it was this bad spiral. And so she said, you know, my mother just drives me crazy. She just, you know, she can't just give me the money. She has to give me the lecture. And I said, well, you know, okay, so what did she say? And she knew the speech exactly. The kind of things, her mother had three or four things she would say. You know, you need to be more responsible. It was the typical stuff. So I said, well, why don't you, instead of being a victim of this, pretend you're the director and get your mother in your own mind to deliver the lines perfectly with just the right amount of guilt and nuance that, you know, she knows how to do so well. And she, you know, she laughed. She, you know, meanwhile, we'll work with you on budgeting and making sure you're more responsible and things like that. But so your mother won't drive you crazy. And they went out to lunch, same situation. Her mother, they went out to the car afterwards, and her mother was giving her a ride home. And her mother started in, and she was just sitting there going, when is she going to say this line? And then she said the line, and it was perfectly delivered. And she began to laugh. And her mother said, what are you laughing about? She goes, you delivered that line so perfectly. And her mother said, I did, didn't I? And they both laughed. And it totally shifted the thing. And she was stopping feeling like she was a victim and her mother's driving her crazy. Instead, she was like, this is what we do together. And, you know, she's perfect at her part. I'm just not going to do my part. And so, you know, it's that sense of how can you shift the focus off the other person? And even if the other person is doing something to you, how do you take back your power? And that was one way she could. So it's just an idea of how to shift that focus.
This kind of interpersonal work shows how pain and discomfort, when used properly, can be an effective catalyst for change. In the next module, we'll look at ways to shift a fixed mindset toward a growth mindset. I'll see you there.